Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have you ever tuned into a police scanner? If you find the right frequency, you can listen in on some of the conversations between local officers.
445, you can cancel.
Okay, maybe that doesn't sound like fun to you, but that's what a Cal State geographer and science teacher does in his free time at his home in Thousand Oaks. Or he'll use his amateur radio to talk to people all over the world. When he's not doing that, he's looking at satellites to learn more about natural disasters in California. Now, mostly that means wildfires. But recently, that's meant drought, too.
I was just doing it because I like playing with the tools and playing with satellite information, and it's all free, so I just like playing with it.
His most recent find? A satellite that shows how much people are watering their yards. I'll just say some folks are doing a much better job at following the drought rules than others. And one person knows who you are. KCRW's Kaylee Wells spent the afternoon with the natural disaster aficionado and how he's responding to the most recent one.
Ben Kuo didn't start out as the Twitter source for Southern California disaster information. He started out as a dad, trying to satisfy his son's curiosity.
He was interested in listening to the fire and police radio when he was in elementary school, all things. It became a lot more than a simple hobby for me.
Then fast forward to 2017, when Hurricane Maria devastated Puerto Rico and wiped out the tiny island country of Dominica.
They had no phone. They had no internet. They had no communications at all. Yeah. And the world didn't know that. And the only way to talk to them was amateur radio.
He says he passed messages between the residents there and the U.S. Embassy, which eventually sent helicopters to rescue U.S. citizens from the wreckage.
And then shortly thereafter was the Thomas Fire.
Another natural disaster, this time closer to his home in Ventura County. It's still one of the largest wildfires in state history.
And I said, oh, I can, as an amateur radio operator, I can hear what the police and fire are doing. They have open frequencies in these counties here, which is great, so the citizens can know what's going on. I was taking information from there and putting on my social media account.
Super useful for evacuees and local news reporters who followed him. He snoops through satellite data, too. Last year, he found 15 minutes of fame with a write-up in the Washington Post for rescuing a hiker who went missing. He used one blurry photo the guy took of the ground to figure out his location and led sheriff's deputies right to him.
And so that sort of has drawn me into some of this other stuff.
And this other stuff has helped him demonstrate something else he's passionate about, that humans have changed the environment.
A lot of the disasters that we see and that I've been involved with helping out with wildfires are driven by the climate. Hurricanes, there's just so many things, flash flooding, and then just in general, they're all kind of tied together.
Then in June, most local water agencies told customers to cut back their water use during the drought. And he noticed something strange from a satellite he was monitoring.
And one of these things that you can look at is called moisture index, which is used, again, you know, for vegetation management and wildfires and whatnot. And it happens that the satellite has enough that you can tell where things are dry or wet on a much higher resolution.
So high a resolution that he can zoom into your house and see how wet your yard is. A house whose owner doesn't water the yard at all might show up orange on the satellite data. One that's flouting the restrictions will show up blue. Kuo found an entire neighborhood lit up bright blue in Camarillo in Ventura County. So we went to go check it out. Even in the middle of the day, stepping onto the lawn by the entrance, I got my shoes wet.
We're sitting here. Obviously, they've been watering now. The neighborhood is all bright, 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 bright blue, more so than anywhere else in the county.
This is Leisure Village. It's a 55 and older community, and it's actually not breaking any drought rules by running the sprinklers in the middle of the day.
And that's because they are using the reclaimed water.
This community siphons off recycled water from a nearby treatment plant. It doesn't get restricted like potable water. Outside of Leisure Village, Kuo says Camarillo is a great place to find the people who are following the drought rules and who aren't, because their water rules are some of the strictest in Southern California.
We are very reliant on state water, and so that may be contributing to why we have to be more restrictive.
Deborah Gallegos with the City of Camarillo says residents are only allowed 15 minutes of outdoor watering once per week. She says three violations mean $600 in fines. A fourth violation might mean the city turns your water pressure way down.
We do have a water patrol that actually goes out during the day and the evenings at this point and monitors the residents' usage.
Quo says no water agency has approached him to use this tool he's found. Gallegos says they're just responsible for meeting the mandatory reduction numbers. The city of Camarillo has been tasked with reducing their imported water use by 35%. And right now, their current methods are doing the trick. Walking around a regional park a couple miles from that wet, lush neighborhood, Quo walks across the crunchy, iconic, dead, brown grass that gives California its title of the Golden State.
If you're out in the hills here just hiking around, just realize when things get dry here, how dry it is. And I don't think when you're inside your house with air conditioning on, do you realize how bad the drought is unless you walk out into it.
On his social media, he jokes about how his posts shaming some of the water-hogging households might not be all that popular with the water hogs. But when it comes to policing water use, desperate times call for desperate measures.
We're kind of in a climate emergency right now, and we're running out of water in Southern California. What do, right? And obviously, you know, voluntary means may not do the trick. Maybe it will. I think they're hoping it will. But if you recall last year where, you know, Governor Newsom said, oh, everyone conserve and everyone just kept on using water, yeah. You know, voluntary restrictions are not that effective, I think.
Meanwhile, Quo says his work is getting some official attention from a local conservation agency.
They are actually very interested in using the satellite maps for figuring out where to plant plants for restoration. So they're trying to restore the ecosystem, and certain plants require a certain amount of moisture, and so they have to find places where the moisture is.
So water agencies for now are sticking with fines and water patrols, leaving Quo with the task of highlighting the households that have figured out how to adapt to the drought, and the households who have failed to get with the program. For KCRW, I'm Kaylee Wells.
Coming up, learning a new language is hard. Imagine the pressure of learning it in order to help save it from extinction. That story is yours on the other side of this.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. There are more than 100 indigenous languages spoken right here in California, but a lot of them are facing extinction. Now, these languages aren't used much anymore, and even those that are being used often aren't being taught to the next generations. It's like that skill you once had when you were a kid, but because you haven't used it in years, you don't know how to use it anymore. Well, the Serrano tribe is native to the San Bernardino Mountains and other parts of Southern California. Its language was at one point only fluently spoken by a single woman. But some passionate folks in Riverside County have fought to preserve this language, and it's still being taught today. Ernest Siva is one of the few remaining historians of the Serrano language. He founded the Dorothy Ramon Learning Center, which aims to preserve and share the indigenous language traditions of Southern California. Hi, Ernest.
Hello.
Also joining us is his student, Mark Araujo Levinson. He is a preservation specialist with the Morongo Cultural Heritage Department and a senior at Cal State San Bernardino. Mark, welcome to you.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much for having me.
Ernest, I want to start with you. You heard the Serrano language as a young boy growing up on the Morongo Reservation in Riverside County. It was your aunt, Dorothy Ramon, who was actually the last fluent speaker of the language. Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, it was up to her to do something drastic about saving the language since it was disappearing. And earlier, of course, her two sisters were the one's main speakers and, well, the whole family. And that was the picture at that time.
When did you become aware that the language was beginning to fade away? And why did you decide to try and preserve it?
Well, I, very early I realized, in fact, the whole family would joke about it. You know, they knew that it was slipping away because others in the tribe weren't speaking. There were a few, and the elders, and so the picture was quite clear. And I became serious about it toward the end. But when I did realize that I did all I could, grabbing onto all different sources outside of our speakers, you know, in other words, scholarly works and that sort of thing.
You opened the Dorothy Ramone Learning Center in your aunt's honor and name. It's where you and Mark met. How has the center been a hub for the preservation of all languages and other indigenous traditions?
We do have programs in art and music and lecture series and earlier programs for kids. We have a library that, research library that will be available to the public when it's finished. Besides the Morongo, there's the Yohaviyatam. Yeah, they're in Highland. That's near San Bernardino. And they have linguists with whom I've worked for 20 years or so. And we've met, have been meeting on a regular once a week, and fine dictionary has taken shape, and it's in finishing stages.
Mark, what drew you to the center, and how has your relationship with Ernest and the Serrano language evolved since you got involved?
At first, I was learning the Kahuilla language. I bought a book that teaches the Kahuilla language, but one thing that was troubling for me was I had no idea what the language sounded like. So it was really kind of hard to connect with it in a language I've never heard and nor know what it sounds like. And I remember looking in the, you know, Google and looking at the different languages around the area, and Serrano was one of them. And that's when I met Ernest, and that was November of 2017. And I remember he taught me a few words that day, and I kind of, you know, asked if would you mind meeting again. And as we would meet, of course, I knew him, was getting to know him as a person, but also I was able to hear the language from a speaker who heard the language. You know, it was a little bit more personal on that level. And, you know, fast forward to now, it's nice to be able to speak with them.
I can imagine how difficult it is to learn a language that you've never witnessed before, right? You've never heard a word uttered from that language before. What were your first words?
It was like the basics. Like, you know, if you learn like French or Italian, you know, you start with hi, how are you, what's your name?
Which is, how do you say that?
So hi to one person, because you distinguish between one person and multiple people. So if I was saying hi to you, I would say huminut. But if I'm saying hi to you and Ernest, I would say humintumsh.
Mark, in a recent op-ed for the LA Times, you talk about some of the other efforts to preserve indigenous languages across California. A lot of Native Americans don't have a very strong connection to their tribal or indigenous background. I mean, when you talk about growing up in a city, going to regular public schools, speaking English, how important is the language itself as a way to access and to continue to connect to that heritage?
Well, one thing that helped me connect to just the surrounding areas, because this is where Serrano was spoken, was especially when I would learn about place names or some of the history, it put everything into context and it put everything in perspective. So an example, I think of Yucaipa, which is a city out that way towards Redlands, and that's actually a Serrano word. And it gives me context because it translates to something like the mountain wilderness.
That's what yucaipa means?
Yeah, it's an amalgamation of the two words, yupa and kaich. So yupa is like the wild, and kaich is a mountain. So it kind of mixes those two words together. Yeah, so it's like, it might not look like that now, but it gives you a peek into what it did look like to them.
For the people interested, of course, the youngsters on the reservation, well, living anywhere in the country, the language is what pulls them in a mysterious way. And I think that has to do with our belief that what the elders would tell us, never forget your language. You know, you have to learn all sorts of new things in this world, the new way, as we used to say. But never forget learn your language. Never forget it, because if you do, you'll be lost. Your people will be lost and wondering who you were and et cetera, you know. And remember your language pass it on to your kids.
Ernest Siva is co-founder of the Dorothy Ramon Learning Center, along with his wife, and Mark Araujo Levinson, a language preservation specialist with the Morongo Cultural Heritage Department. How do you say thank you, Ernest?
Hakupa'ai.
Hakupa'ai. Is that right?
A'ai.
A'ai.
Good.
A'ai.
A'ai means good also.
Thank you so much to you both. Mark, thank you.
Hakupa'ai.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, animal rights activists want L.A. developers to reflect on how dangerous high-rise glassy buildings are to birds. Stick around. We're back after this. More of Greater L.A. now from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. L.A. has done a lot of growing up in the last couple of decades. After a 20th century of sprawl extending out as far as you can reasonably or unreasonably go, developers started aiming for the sky, which is where birds operate. Well, sadly, bird and building collisions happen anywhere there are skyscrapers, killing hundreds of millions of birds, according to the Audubon Society. One skyscraper to be in Hollywood is an egg-shaped tower called the Star. And the Audubon Society here in L.A., along with PETA, they say the building's architects can do a better job of making it safer for birds. Here to explain is Travis Longcore, president of the Los Angeles Audubon Society. Hey, Travis.
Hi, Steve.
Hundreds of millions of birds dying every year colliding with buildings. That's obviously an incredible number. It's the windows, right?
It is the windows, glass. Yeah, birds don't see glass as a barrier, or they see the reflection of either trees or the sky in it and think that it's the trees or the sky and not the glass.
How bad is the problem here in LA?
Well, we know that this happens because it happens everywhere there is glass and birds. And we have studies from San Francisco looking at bird collisions, and we have anecdotal observations in Los Angeles and a pretty impressive migration that comes through here in the spring and the fall. So birds are being killed at buildings in Los Angeles as part of the between 365 million and a billion birds across the United States.
Does it matter, Travis, you know, how high the building is?
The very tall ones do get into the range where there's probably two things going on. One is the glass during the day, but the second is the lights, because a lot of our birds migrate at night because it's cooler for them to do it that way, and they are attracted to lights at night. So our very tall buildings have sort of the dual process. One is the attraction of birds to the lights, and then during the day, those birds are in the city exposed to all of the dangers of the city, and also often these walls of glass that they don't perceive as a barrier and often end up colliding with. So tall buildings have this dual thing, but the majority of bird window collisions actually happen at low rise and residences.
The Star development in Hollywood, this one's going to be 22 stories, apparently. Shiny, obviously, a lot of glass. What are some examples of architecture that is safe for birds, and how does the Star, what do you recommend the architects or the builders do for the Star to make it safer for birds?
Right. So architects are problem solvers. And I know this from having taught in architectural school for a while. And what needs to happen there is it just needs to be identified as an issue so that they can figure out how they want to solve it. The problem with this is that the environmental review didn't consider bird mortality at all. And so the request here is go back and look at this and figure out how to solve that problem. There are a number of ways and that architects and designers can do this by breaking up expanses of glass, by using different glass products that may have fritting or other ways that make the glass more visible to the birds. There are guidelines for this. There's a pilot credit in LEED, which is the guidance for environmental friendly building. And we've actually worked on implementing those recommendations into the actual software that architects use in order to be able to identify what the risks are, where they are, and how you can go ahead and mitigate it in the design phase. Because that's where it's the easiest to deal with this is before you build the building as opposed to after.
A wildlife ordinance that aims to protect areas of the Santa Monica Mountains, this is between the 405 and the 101 freeways, would include requirements for bird-safe buildings, as it were. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Right. So it would, for new construction, so either major remodel additions or new buildings, require that glass panes that are more than 24 square feet use some strategy to reduce the amount of bird mortality. You know, there's bird-friendly glass, and there are a bunch of options that you can use there that range from, as I mentioned, some of these things with little dots or ultraviolet coatings that birds can see but humans can't.
Are you seeing builders and developers do this kind of stuff more often now, Travis?
Absolutely. And there are actually some architectural firms that specialize in bird-friendly building. There's a executive order from the, I'm hoping I remember right, the Clinton administration that basically says that the federal buildings will be bird-friendly. And so there's our new embassy in London is a completely bird-friendly building. The federal building downtown, I believe, is bird-friendly design, and there's a major remodel of the Javits Center that took it from being pretty much a massive bird killer to being a very bird-friendly building by changing out the glass. And they actually even added some other elements like green roofs and whatnot, where some birds are now nesting. So this is they're also required bird-friendly guidelines in New York and San Francisco. We're a bit behind here in Los Angeles in getting there, but we should be able to, and it's a specialty. And often there's some benefits that come along with bird-friendly building in that when you get away from just big walls of glass, there tend to be some advantages in terms of the heat management to reduce their cooling costs.
Well, thanks for coming on and talking with us about it. Travis Longcore, president of the Los Angeles Audubon Society. Travis, have a great day.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Tomorrow, the transformation of Jordan Downs housing project in Watts and the future of public housing. Should you even call it that anymore? That's yours in Greater LA. Tomorrow on KCRW. Always online, by the way, at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. Tell us how you're doing. Give us some story ideas. Subscribe to the podcast, too. You know, we're more than just a show. We're a podcast, and you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. You don't have to just listen at 2:30 and 6. You can have it delivered fresh to your feed just by subscribing to the Greater LA Podcast. Search for Greater LA KCRW. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Rebecca Ludman, Sonia Geis, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all made this evening's episode possible. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thank you for your time and your ears. Have a great evening.